So hi guys, welcome, and everybody online, welcome along to our class, How to Meditate. So we begin as we normally do by doing a short breathing meditation. I'll set the motivation up and then we'll take refuge and generate the mind of enlightenment together. So just get comfortable in your seat, meaning make sure that your back is straight, your shoulders relaxed, place your hands wherever you like. And you can keep your eyes open or close them. So while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, become aware of any movements that take place in the body when you inhale or exhale. And in your own time, I'd like to count the breath. So on the inhale, just relax, breathe in. On the exhale, I relax and then count there. So the first time you exhale will be one, and the second time will be two. So in your own time, just up to seven, please. Now imagine in the space in front of you is Shakyamuni Buddha, surrounded by the bodhisattvas and spiritual mentors. The body of the Buddha is made of golden light. And imagine that surrounding you are all sentient beings. Your left is your mother and your right is your father. Behind you are your closest friends and family, and in front of you are strangers. And that each one of these persons is experiencing some form of suffering, some more obvious, other types of suffering quite subtle. So some are obviously experiencing pain. Others, they are happy, but the happiness is in the process of change, so it's vanishing. Whereas every one of us has a body and the mind of a human being that experiences all pervasive conditionality, the most deepest form of suffering. And this is basically because we have a body and mind that is not under our control. Now everyone wishes to avoid suffering and to do the best they can to do that, but what they do actually produces more suffering. So they lack the genuine happiness they're seeking. Nevertheless, all these forms of suffering can be put to an end and genuine happiness realized, because this is the natural potential of the mind. In fact, the causes of suffering have never actually penetrated the mind itself. So if we are to dispel the causes of our suffering and actualize genuine happiness, we need to rely on those who have already done it, the methods that they've taught, and a community. And these, in fact, are the beings in front of us, the Buddha, the Sangha of Bodhisattvas, and the teachings themselves that they embody. So we're going to take refuge in these three rare sublime ones, so that we can put an end to our own suffering and help others do the same. So if you can just recite along with me, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So with this aspiration, heard by the Buddha and his assembly, I think that from the heart of the Buddha now, rays of light and nectar emanate, move through space and wash over yourself and all the beings surrounding you. And they remove the obstacles that you have and empower your potential. So while you're imagining seeing this light and feeling it, breathe it in through your nostrils, and then each time you exhale, breathe out sort of black light or black colored cloudy light. Just do this for 7 breaths. Breathing in the color and light, exhaling the obstacles of darkness. So I think that the potential you have to become fully awakened has been awoken. Now this has taken place. Nevertheless, sentient beings still abide in conflict. And this is basically because they have not been able to actually put the potential into effect. They haven't developed 4 immeasurable thoughts. So let's make the wish now that they do so, with the understanding that we'll help them to do so. So may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. I think to accomplish this, I've got to actually accumulate all the causes to do so and abandon anything that hinders it. And all the practices to do so are summed up in this prayer called the 7 limbs, so we can recite that together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And I finally abandon the subtle graspings that we have to the body, to the mind, and to all of our ideas. We make an offering of a mandala. And I think that in the offering of it, the grasping that we have to the mind and the body and to our ideas vanishes. And in its absence, a wonderful pure land appears, whereby we can give teachings to others in the future. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, 4 continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamriyatayami. So release the offering. The Buddha accepts it and smiles at us with delight. And now we look up and look into the Buddha's eyes. Notice the smile he's given to you. And while he's smiling at you, think that the vast refuge field around him begins to dissolve into light and melt into the Buddha. An emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space, comes to abide directly above the crown of your head, and descending through space, enters your skull, comes down inside the body, and rests at the level of the heart. There, the brightness of his body begins to expand, filling all the space inside your body, filling your mind, and then going out through the pores of your skin to fill all of space. Wherever there are beings within that space, they are fully awakened, and there is no difference between the self and them. In fact, the ideas of self and other have completely vanished. This is a non-dual state of the awareness and the appearance. Those two vanishes. We find ourselves embodied, breathing normally and naturally, sitting in our seat, inhaling and exhaling normally and naturally. I'm thinking that we are here to develop all of the good qualities of the mind as a means to free all beings, ourselves included, of suffering and its causes, and establish everyone to the highest state of full enlightenment. Now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and allow yourself to open your eyes and be at ease in your seat. So as you know, this is the class number 5, which means we've gone through 4 classes already, and we've covered a bit of material. We've looked at what meditation is and its purpose, so we know that meditation is becoming familiar with a virtuous object, try and change the mind, and the purpose we can bring to it is to develop a full awakening to help others. This is the best purpose we can give to the mind, to our way of living and being, and for meditating. And there are many different types of meditation, and we've been focusing on at present what they call stabilizing meditation. Today, we're going to sort of move away from that a little and go to another form of meditation called analytical meditation. Now, one of the purposes of stabilizing is to use the process of visualization, and in particular, the visualization of Shakyamuni Buddha. And there are many good reasons for doing that. One of them, the Buddha just being an object of virtue itself, but then also it helps us develop, if we engage in the practice of Tantra, as a very good, useful image to recall at the time of death. Now, there's going to be many obstacles we're going to will challenge us. Some of the earliest ones are just laziness. We don't want to do it, or we think we don't have enough time, or we do lots of other things. There is also sleepiness, lethargy, excitement, regret, and so forth. And we'll be talking a bit more about some of those obstacles again today. Now, whenever we engage in meditation, there's two really important things. One is always to reaffirm the purpose of meditating, and always at the end of it, dedicate the effort that you've put into meditating towards that end goal. Now, our topics today, we're going to basically answer 6 questions. We're going to look again at stabilizing meditation. And in it, we're going to look at some of the obstacles called excitement and distraction. And we're going to look at some of what they are as obstacles and how we can actually oppose them. We're going to again look at this next step in terms of the serenity meditation, which will be the third step. And on the basis of that, have a look at what analytical meditation is and how we apply that in relation to the topic called impermanence. And these are the books. Oopsie, that was quick. These are the books I've been using. So here you can see I've bought two new books into it. And these are basically
one that you just bought, isn't it?
this is one I just bought called The Attention Revolution. But it's not that book. The two books, the new here, are these two books called The Science and Philosophy in the Indian Buddhist Classics. So one is on the mind itself, and the other is on the physical world. Now, if you ever do decide to become serious about study of Buddhism, I'd recommend you get these two books. You'll always be picking them up and looking through them. I've never come across some such fine detail, and yet it's readable and understandable. So they're quite thick, and there might be, I think, one or two more volumes coming.
How many volumes
are there? There's these two. So there might only be just one more. So it's like that's His Holiness often talking about starting off with Buddhist science, then Buddhist philosophy, and then culminating in Buddhist religion. So here we've got the science and the philosophy, these two. And they're particularly useful in talking about the topic of impermanence. That's why I've sort of used it. And the obstacles that you get from meditating. So I've used the stuff from there. You'll see on the differences between what they call when the mind scatters, excitement and distraction. So they're all the three terms, or three different meanings, and you find about it in this book. The others are much easier to get your head around and read. But like I said, these two, science and philosophy, they're quite thick. They'll always they're like encyclopedias. They're great resources. So we'll talk about this. We've been talking about stabilizing meditation, and this is the third step in it. So remember, we started off by setting the mind first of all. Then we had to set it again. And now we have to reset it. Now we're going to talk about this resetting. So as you can see this time, we have the monk. He's actually got his rope, which is the rope of mindfulness, remember? He's actually got it around the elephant now.
Yeah.
Before he was chasing it, the elephant's actually walking. He slowed right down, he's turned around, and now he's got a white head, and the monkey and the rabbit have both got white heads. So that means we've been moderately successful in taming the mind. It's actually slowed down, and the blackness, the wildness is changing. So it says here, the monk has finally, with the rope of mindfulness, gained a hold of the elephant and has turned the head towards him. This means that there are more periods of remembrance and control than there are forgetfulness. This is called a patchy placement or resetting the mind. So it's called patchy placement, like putting patches on a cloth to fix up holes. Mm. One is basically patching their awareness onto the practice. So there are still periods of forgetfulness, but there's more remembrance than there is forgetfulness. And there's a real big improvement at this stage. The monkey has also become more purified. So monkey, of course, loses excitement. So excitement has diminished a little. The rabbit represents a laxity, and that's diminished a little also. So this is where we begin to actually tame the mind. So we actually remember that we are trying to develop a concentrated state of mind. We haven't forgotten that. So there's still a bend in the road, as you can see here, the monk is on. That represents the power of mindfulness. It's walking off towards the next stage called where this placement's actually attained. So the animals looking backward indicate that the mind is gaining strength over the faults. It represents the mind's ability to return to the meditation object after recognizing mental wandering. So here's another slide talking about this. So here we got, once again, the monk has got a hold of the elephant with his rope of mindfulness. The little symbols up there still say that the mind can still be distracted to the objects of the senses, the laxity. No, it's always been there, but it hasn't been highlighted because that's not the major problem. The major problem when we begin is excitement and distraction.
Is not even being able to focus.
Or being lazy, and not even being able to focus on the object at all. So laxity is actually sort of more like you've actually got the object, but it's not appearing clearly to you. But at this stage, it sort of is. But before, you couldn't sort of get a hold of the object. Remember the first one, and then the second one was like 21 breaths, well, now you've actually got a hold of it. So those were the problems then. So here, like I said, yeah, we've still got these problems, this laziness, which was a major problem of the first and second stages. We've still got some forgetfulness, but it's getting in check, you know. And we still have, of course, what they call coarse excitement, which is this monkey mind. But we can see the head is white, so we're doing a bit better than before. So we've still got to aspire to develop concentration. We've got to make efforts in it. And the major factor in play here is what we call mindfulness. So remember, mindfulness is just this thing that we remember what to do. And when we find that we're not actually doing it, we've forgotten, or the mind's moved off, as Ben pointed out last week, we have this sort of metacognition, often called vigilance or introspection. Another part of the mind knows, oh, my God, I've lost it. I better put it back on. Mindfulness comes back on, holds it again, as long as you can. And then, as well as that, this meta-awareness or introspection notices, how well am I holding the object? Is it dull? And what's the mind like itself? What's the mind like that's holding this object?
And is there any reason why the rabbit is on the elephant, like riding the elephant?
Yeah, because the mind is lax, it's not.
Oh, that's right. And so the mind and the monkey and the elephant are both representing the mind.
The mind, that's right. All three of these are mind itself. Yeah. The elephant, the rabbit, and the monkey are all mind. In fact, all the pictures are about the mind. The flame on the side is also the mind. The so things that it is, the mind distracting.
Because the rabbit's like getting a free ride. The monkey's jumping around all over the place. The lax rabbit's just hitchhiking.
So it won't be clear to most people what these terms actually mean, I think. So this is why it's important, like those books are very good, because it sees that laxity is not just a dull mind, it's not sleepiness. There's big differences between laziness, sleepiness, and laxity. No, this is mainly the mental consciousness. So the visual consciousness doesn't really have this problem. Auditory consciousness doesn't have this problem. This is mainly mental consciousness, because the mind is being drawn inward. Right, it's not used to that. Yep, that's right. Everybody's mind's already off with the pixies, off with the monkeys. Yep, that's right. So this third mental abiding called Apache placement or resetting is the point at which predominant afflictive emotions often impede progress. So that what happens, what that means is now you're suddenly going to find you can't go beyond this. It's very hard to stay here. And the question is why? He says, well, the afflictive mental states that you may not have been aware of now make themselves known. So you might have, like, you might be meditating because you're basically an angry person. So you're trying to calm down, right? the resentment's going to come up now. Yeah, so it's like, okay, so you need to deal with the resentment before you can make go on. Yep, and yep, that's right. So what you need to be there is like identify it. So you know, you, like you say, a traumatic experience. You go, well, a traumatic experience is made up of all these different factors. Within all those mental factors, what's coming up? Is it fear? Is it disgust? Is it anger? Is this having that term, traumatic experience? You've got to go, you know, you say, well, what's that? Then you have to say, well, this is what happened to me. Yeah, okay, now we can break it down. Because it might be that you've served in the army. You've been overseas. So there's a lot of fear there. And you've been trying to meditate to sort of, you know, calm down, not be afraid. Well, now it shows itself.
So, and it shows itself because you've actually made some space and stopped running and panicking.
That's right. You've actually seen what's going on, what the mind is actually doing. So, you know, Miffy told me, said an interesting thing to me the other day. She said that some therapist had said to one of her patients that trauma gets into your bones. So if you think about that, is that like literally true or is that a metaphor? Yeah. It's a metaphor, isn't it? It's deeply embedded. But the thing is, you know, it can only be embedded dependent upon consciousness. If you weren't conscious of the event, you wouldn't be traumatized by it, would you?
And the consciousness you bring to it changes what the event is.
That's right. So you can, you know, look at this. These. So you'll find your inner world will become more obvious to you. So most of the time it hasn't been. You know, like you've been thinking so much you don't actually know what's going on. It's just so fast. Now things have slowed down enough. And you say, oh, this is the one that's coming up all the time. You know, okay, then you need to deal with that. And the way that you deal with that is often through analysis.
So is that totally different from just being re-traumatized? Because this time you're looking at it, you're not 100% identified with it.
Yeah, and we have a purpose here. Our purpose is to actually concentrate the mind. And we can see that our past is hindering us. These afflictions that we've had and developed are actually hindering our development of concentration. So we've got a bigger goal. Yeah, and that's why, like I said, as a Buddhist, there is something much better than that, isn't there? Yeah, there's awakening, there's Buddhahood itself. But to have to know that that can actually happen, can actually take place, we need to know stuff about it. So yesterday I did a class on the Buddha nature and being a human being and then meeting a teacher and then looking at the problems of cyclic existence. So when you have a look at the Buddha nature, the deepest nature of the mind, it's obvious you can be free. It's really obvious. All that's required for us now is to do the work. And in that, like I said, obviousness, what I'm saying there is the nature of the disturbing emotions or the afflictions or what you find in your mind that comes up, it's adventitious, meaning it comes and goes. Right? So you're going to go, well, why isn't it always there? Why aren't I traumatized all the time? Why aren't I freaked out all the time? Yeah, that's right. And if the cause and conditions aren't there, the trauma's not. But once the conditions come into support, well, off you go again, isn't it? So that's you go, oh my gosh, if I change the causal conditions, I can certainly change conditions. The deepest causes are going to always be there unless I uproot them with the analysis. This karma body, this concentrated state is not going to get rid of them. I could acknowledge, like I have this, you know, like if it was the fear or doubt, you go, well, what opposes fear or doubt? What's the opposite of that? You find out what that is and you go, I'll concentrate my mind on that. If you do that, the fear one can't come up. Can't hold two opposite states of mind at the same time. It's impossible. But nevertheless, the cause is still there. You know? So we need to do something about that, which is analysis. Now, there's even deeper cause than that. There are deeper causes than that. The major thing for that is it's the way we're apprehending the trauma and ourselves. That's the fault. What's our relationship to the trauma? How does this trauma actually exist? Because anyone knows who's experiencing trauma, in the time it happens, it's real to you. So we have to examine that and that reality. What does that mean? Because the actual event that produced that trauma is not happening, is it? Mm-hmm. So it's not that real. It's a complete mental construction, but it produces results. So this is where you have to stop at this stage often. Think, okay, now I need to do this other thing. And that's why you'll see in Alan Wallace's books, he will complement the practices of concentration with loving kindness meditation, compassion meditation, joy and equanimity. So in other words, we reinforce our reason for doing this. We try to be compassionate and kind to ourselves. We're the one, we're dealing with our problems, not the psychologist or the psychiatrist. We are. And so we have to take a kind approach to this. It's actually an act of kindness towards ourselves to do this. Not because we love ourselves, because we care about ourselves. We also know that this is really difficult. It's causing suffering, so we have compassion towards ourselves. And so this is why, like I said, it's a very useful way to complement just concentrative states with other types of meditation too. And this is once again where analysis comes in, because if you want to do meditation on love, it requires analysis. You have to actually know what's the love I'm talking about here. How do I develop it? What does it mean to be compassion? What do I have to do that? So that's not just sitting and, breathing. Yes, your question.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think we've got a slide on that, haven't we? Just on that one. Can you see? I'll just put it in there.
Hold that thought.
That was yesterday's class, or maybe next week's. But so we need both together, and they've got to function together, the analysis and the stabilization. We train in them separately, but they've got to be brought together. So they give this great example of, if you want to see, suppose we're in a dark cave, right? And in the walls of these caves are some paintings. So in Europe, that there are, and Australia too, aren't there? There are cave paintings in the dark, right? So we want to have a look at them. And you think, well, I need some light. So we don't have a torch or something, so suppose we grab some candles and we light it, right? So we put it up and we look at the pictures. The problem is the flame keeps flickering. So the picture's never, ever clear. We don't get it all. So this flame is the insight. You're getting to see it, but it's wobbly. So you need to protect the flame.
It's really elusive, especially when trying to work something out. You get it and then you fall off again.
That's right. So you get it and you fall off. You get it, you fall off. You see it, you don't see it, right? Then you've got to get up closer. When you do that, then this other bit moves out. So I've got to protect the flame, you realise. So you put a glass over it. Now the flame is stable. So the glass over the flame is calm abiding mind. You can concentrate it so the flame doesn't waver. Then you can see the picture very clearly. And that's very common.
Yeah.
So the example I gave was turn out into the world, right?
Yeah.
Here, concentration is turned inwards. concentrating outside like artists do and musicians do, which they're required. They've got a lot of analysis. They've got to keep their mind firmly on the job and away they go. That's how you do it externally in the world. Internally, the objects are in here, mental objects. You've got to hold them, become familiar with them. That requires mindfulness, introspection, to hold the mindfulness. It's got to be holding. Right? That means a concentrated state of mind. The analysis has got to know, like, what am I holding? What's the purpose of holding this? And the analysis here is a reason. Analysis comes through reason. It's not pictures or anything like that. All the pictures are part of the method. The reason, and the reason is correct. There's no way you can fault this reasoning. All doubts are done with. You've done away with the doubts. You've questioned it. You've got it. Don't let it go. So, like, for instance, simply put, you know, when you go around and you see, well, all the time, people doing very, you know, what call bad things, unskillful behaviors. People all over the world are doing this. You're hurting themselves, they're hurting others. Oftentimes, if they hurt your friends, your family, you are not going to like it. If they hurt you, you won't like it either, right? So what do you do when that happens? What's your thinking?
Angry.
You become angry, don't you? Straight off. No, then you want to hurt them. You want to harm them. So you don't like them harming you, but now you want to hurt them. Right? Now there's something a bit wobbly about that, isn't there? And you look at that and you go like, you know, why, what's behind here? What's going on that I should now want to hurt them? There's some sort of thing where you think for starters it's not fair. And in a way that this person actually has some control over, they intend to do this. So out of these ideas, you have anger. But what if you thought this person doesn't have control over their mind? What if you thought they're actually like sick?
Or fearful.
Frightened, scared. Then you might then have a different approach to them. So the approach is this being is suffering. That's what we're going to lock in. Sentient beings, people who are not enlightened, are suffering. Take an ordinary being. They are suffering. Why? Because they have no control over themselves. You know, reason is to start off with ordinary being. Yep, it's true, they have no control over themselves. Does suffering come out of having no control over yourself? Yes, it does. This is what I need to remember. I've got to hold on to that. So now you walk around the world, you see anybody doing anything silly, what we normally used to call silly, wrong, bad, we don't call it that. We see this is suffering.
Or if you're His Holiness, you see a suffering friend who you just don't agree with.
Yeah. Now, so there's a lot of other meditations that go along, because, like we've said, to point out the friendliness of that person. They're actually your friend suffering. No, it's not hard. You just have to do it. You have to know the reasons.
Doing it is very hard.
It won't be hard if you agree, if you see that this is the fact. It's not hard to agree with facts. It's very easy to, in fact. And that's what analysis does. It makes it easy for you. You don't have doubt. You have lots of doubts beforehand, and that's fine. And we put them all up and then we shoot them all down. And we let them go because they don't stand up to reasoning. Once the reason's there, though, mindfulness goes, whoops, I hold it. So in relation to what we're doing here on just the breath, right? So if we take, we're meant to be meditating on the breath, right? So you go, okay, so I'm meant to be meditating, I'm meant to always know that sentient beings are suffering. When we're on the breath, we're finally on the breath, but then we move off. We're thinking about lunch. One part of one is, oh my God, I'm thinking about lunch, I should be on my breath. Oh, I'll go back. When your mind is on the suffering of sentient beings, and then you see that person, blah, 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 you've got to go, oh, my gosh, I've moved off their suffering, I'm into anger. I've got to bring it back.
And you know who does this all the time is parents. They have to do this all the time with your kids, because you have to move it off the anger back to the suffering, needy child. Otherwise, you're in really big trouble.
Yeah.
So it is possible to do. I mean, a vast section of humanity do it, but they just do it for their immediate family.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you thought about the reasoning, you go, well, why are you doing it? Well, obviously, well, I care about my child. Right? So here's this sort of thing, you know, we look reasons, we go, all sentient beings have been our children, all beings have been our mothers, our parents. We've had so many relationships with them. We remember the kindness of them when they were parents. So you need to, you know, it's not just one reason, you back it up with a whole stack of reasons. And then you go, right, this is, like we said, you know, my kind friend, I need to help them stop the suffering that they're going under. Not attack them, not harm them, but help them. So that all requires analysis. But you've got to get deeply under the material, under the appearances, and come up with a new way of being. Oh, okay, so in terms of, like, you know, so in mindfulness, we need to remember what we're holding on to. So we talk about how I've got to remember sentient beings have been kind, have been my mothers, and they're suffering. Remember that, and then, like, when we forget it, refocus. Bring the mind back to it. So you think, that idiot, blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, my gosh, I forgot. Refocus. Back on the sentient being, or back on the breath, whatever the object is, bring it back. As often as you can. You'll do it more often as long as you realize how the purpose of meditation is to make you happier, is to develop virtuous states of mind which produce happiness. And the long-term goal is Buddhahood itself. But in this life, you'll be happier. Depend upon the analysis, your reasoning, and the ability to keep the mind on that object. Now, of course, what stops us to go is what they call coarse excitement, whereby you lose your object of observation. So excitement, this term often literally means wild. The mind has become wild again. So excitement is a non-virtuous mental factor. It has the subjective aspect of not being calm. It's a scattering of the mind to the outside. And it will interrupt your cultivation of meditative stabilization. For instance, if we're sitting here now just doing our breathing meditation, and then somehow or other the smell of a lovely meal came through the room, right? And you smelled it and you started thinking about what you'd like to eat. That would be excitement, coarse excitement. And it's arisen through your senses. Right? Your senses have picked that smell up, and the mind has now moved off the object of the breath and ran off about dinner. That's what I mean, like coarse excitement. The mind just lose the object completely. In terms of what we used before, a politician does something that we really disagree with and we start going blah, blah, blah. It means we've forgotten our object of focus, our poor suffering politician who doesn't know what he's doing, who's out of control. Close my mouth, stop talking about it, go back, poor suffering sentient being.
So the object of observation is, it's not just the politician, but it's the suffering sentient being politician.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's the politician who is suffering. If we wish to develop compassion or love, we have to know that our object will be the politician who wants to be happy. Or if it's compassion, it's the politician who is suffering. And we've got to acknowledge that. Well, we're not disagreeing that they're suffering, and we're not disagreeing that they want to be happy. Of course. Yeah, but at the deepest level, this is a person who wants to be happy, then doesn't know how to be, behaving badly. And through that, they cause themselves more suffering than other people. And at the deepest level, their whole body and mind is pervaded by conditions that produce the suffering, mainly grasping at true existence of things. Now, this excitement also has another level. So that's the coarse level we've just talked about. Just lose your object. The others that you become aware of is that although your mind is on the object, it's like bubbling away under the surface. You can actually feel that. You know, you sit down, believe me, you'll feel it, you'll know. It's like, my God. So I was quite surprised when I felt this myself. It's like, Jesus, it's like the mind wants to go. You can actually feel it doing that. This is coarse excitement. Now, the way to oppose it is different ways. So you've got to move your mind like off that other object. So remember here, with coarse excitement, we're sort of talking here, I find it really difficult to hold my mind on the object. So I've got to do something else. So you go, okay, drop just the breath or the Buddha or whatever it is, because I can't, you know, it's too, getting too excited. I need a different object. So you bring a black drop down to here at the level of the navel. So black is dark. It's not like to get excited. Right? It's the opposite of the bright, excited lights. So it's black. You put it down here because this is where you get hurt, you get grounded. You don't, it's not you're not up in your head anymore. You come down, stabilize yourself. And another way you can do it is just the inhalation of the breath. So not so much at the nostrils anymore, but come down again. Try and feel the breath in the body.
Yeah, so not shallow breathing.
Not shallow breathing and not,
breathing from the
and
abdomen.
Not subtle. Yeah, that's right. Make it more coarse so you can drive your attention, your awareness downwards again. Sink it. And then see if you can hold, get back, come back, the get that stabilized. Now try and put it back on the object. Because it's not so much the object here, it's the mind itself. But the mind is excited, so we've got to bring it down a bit and now see if we can put it on our object and hold it on the object.
So it's like the mind is spinning its gears in a way,
yeah.
And so you've got to go down a lower gear.
Yeah. You know, even so, like, even that's fine, stop and rest. Give the mind a break. I'm not sure what you mean by break, either the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. So I'll say this, so when you... When we come to Buddhist classes, we start studying Buddhism, right? You can get introduced to the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. Right? So when you do, the way you often engage it, first of all, is through reading or listening. Right? Then you need to think about it. Now, when you start to think about it, that now we come into concentration and analysis, which is what our class is about. So the object to be ascertained comes through hearing, reading, listening. That's the first object. Now we've got to make sense of it. Analysis is required. Once you're certain about it, now stabilize your mind on it. So that what we're talking about today goes through all the Buddhist topics, no matter which one it is. If you're talking about this idea of meditation, meditation comes after listening and contemplation. It's the third step. Altogether, those three steps are just called study. But in terms of the development, it's 1, 2, 3. So it's not surprising that we forget the material because we haven't stabilized it. We haven't actually thought about it yet. We haven't actually determined the reasons for the things the Buddha has said. Now, there's another couple of other different things you can do too to bring the mind down is to meditate on death and impermanence, the bad vibrations or the general sufferings of cyclic existence. So this means, of course, as you'll often find, you've already done a great deal of study. Right? You've got a basic overall picture of this whole Buddhist presentation. And now you're sort of quite serious about it, because you are if you're meditating. So you can call upon your prior knowledge of these other topics to stop this exciting mind.
Yeah, it's a very much kind of, come on, Miffy, get serious.
Yeah, but remember, with excitement, what's happening here is the mind is being drawn outwardly and we're trying to keep it inward. on our objects, on our thought objects, our thought constructs, our understandings, our reasons, and so forth. So we need to slow yourself down. Methods that you can use to stop thought patterns or thought habits and sorts of things like that. So some you suppress them. But what I mean by suppressing them, I don't mean just push them down. The way you suppress them, you suppress them by opposing them. So what that means is you've got to put your mind on a different object so that the other one won't raise its head. So that's one method. And then then you've got to keep the mind on that other object, but which requires concentration again. So one of the simplest things people do is when you've got song going through your mind, for instance, or something else, is you realize, that's going on, maybe you don't like it, you don't want to let that keep going. So you've got to bring it to a different object. So that might be your breath. But then you might find, I'm aware of my breath, but I can still hear that song. I can't do it that way. I've got to find something else to do. So Miffy goes through this often. She gets earworms. So you've got to be very careful that you don't have these sorts of things happen to you. Otherwise, they can stay around for a little bit of time. It'd be very difficult. So that's one. You can oppose it with some sort of other object. The other is to what they call transformation. And you go, great, love it. Yeah. So in this one, you might go, this is so distressing. I don't want to hear it. And you go, wow, this is so distressing. It's great. Because my goal here is to free all beings from suffering. That's why I'm meditating and so forth. And now I'm experiencing suffering. It's working. Someone else is not experiencing suffering. I'm doing really good. And this is what I've been wishing for. And then you'll find it doesn't bother you so much because it's accepted. So it's a way of acceptance. The other one is to turn your attention onto it. Don't try and avoid it, look directly into it. And that's what they call recognition. So what is trying to find out, what is this thing that's bothering me? How does it actually exist?
And an analysis.
And there's an analysis. So that's the analysis there. And then go, just look.
So no more.
That's right. Make that the object then, till it vanishes. Now I can go back to my original object. So that's how, if you put all the practices together, that's how you can, that's another way of doing it. Ben, do you have your hand up? Okay.
You do have a slide on that in here.
Okay. So here's distraction. Now, there's a difference between excitement and distraction. So distraction here, you can be scattered towards a variety of objects, and these objects can be attractive, unattractive, or neutral. And so therefore, you could develop either of the three poisons, attachment, hatred, or delusion. Whereas excitement, the previous one, is just attachment. So that's where you get these differences.
And didn't they say with this one too that it's with distraction, it's about non-virtuous objects. It's not just kind of jumping all over the place, but it's about actually the objects themselves are non-virtuous.
Yeah, I did say that in terms of the variety. So in summary, we've got three terms that you'll come across. And the problem here is sometimes different authors use different terms, but it's the same thing they're talking about. So we've got scattering, excitement, and distraction. Excitement and distraction are both forms of scattering. So it goes that way, but scattering is not necessarily excitement and distraction. The other thing is excitement produces the distraction.
So is distraction what happens when you're not dealing with your excitement? and it just keeps on going.
Yeah, that's right. So you, yeah, if you don't deal with the excitement, like I said before, you know, you can notice it. So as you sit down, you get subtle excitement, but you can actually know. And then suddenly you've lost the object, and now it's gross excitement, and you are distracted at that time. Yeah. Now, here we go. So this great quote, Maitreya, you should know that all mundane and supramundane virtuous qualities, whether of the Shravakas, the Bodhisattvas, or the Tathagatas, are the result of serenity and insight. The serenity room is another name for calm abiding, and insight here is another term for analysis. So all forms of meditative concentration can be encompassed by these two categories, a calm abiding, special insight.
There is something about special insight, yeah, that is special.
Right.
Yeah. Isn't special insight?
Well, let's see.
To do with tantra?
No, it can be. That's a form of special insight too. Insight becomes special when it's yoked or joined together with calm abiding. It's special then because it's got bliss driving it. It's a blissful state of mind. You've got mental and physical bliss as well as insight. So it's become special. Up to that point, it's called insight. And you can have insight into all sorts of objects. You can have insight into impermanence, which is a conventional way of existing for products, or you can have insight into emptiness, which is the ultimate way that things exist. You can have insight into how the body exists. So this insight is coming through analysis, reasons. Calm abiding is like, once you've got that insight, you don't let it go. You hold on to it. Why? So it's a thought, isn't it? It's a conception. But if you can take this insight at the normal, ordinary level, focus on it deeply and hold strongly, and then bring it into special insight, you will see it directly, which is what we're trying to do. We want to go beyond just thinking and thoughts. We want to know. And that knowing has to be so deep that you change. So as we said before, you know, it's a difficult thing, isn't it? We know, okay, so we've got it. All sentient beings have been my mothers. They're all suffering. I need to do something about it. Yeah, great, I've got to hold on to that. But then you forget it and so forth. And then does that actually change your way of being? Well, it can do. But until it's really like, you know, you this is true for you. So that's what we've got to make it, because you know, we talk about, you know, true sufferings, true paths. We've got to make it, it's true. So when you yoke them together, over time you see it's true. Before you can see it's true, you've got to believe it's true. Why do you believe it's true? Through your reasoning. You can't fault the reasoning. It's still a belief, it's a correct belief. Actually, it's inference, so it's more than belief. You infer this knowledge upon this vast study. You know, you've got to get them together and then make this change. And that's, so what it's saying here, one of the things it's pointing out, so you can have as your object of calm abiding, emptiness, impermanence, so forth. So emptiness and impermanence, especially subtle impermanence, has to come about through reasoning. Emptiness can only come about through reasoning. So these...
But also loving kindness and compassion,
that's right,
come about through reasoning.
That's right. So there's a thing here. So sometimes you think, look, if it's analysis, it can't be calm abiding. That's not true. He says, the relationship between calm abiding and special insight points to a more general feature of many other meditative practices, such as the cultivation of compassion. Specifically, in analytical meditation, where, for example, one follows a script of discursive contemplations that are intended to induce compassion, is often followed in the same session by placement meditation, such that one lets go of the discursive content and remains non-discursively in the state induced by the analytical meditation. So this, I mean, we've done this before, often towards the negative side of things. And that's all you do is you come up with all the reasons why that person is, or the situation is, and then you stop thinking and you let it sink in, right? And you go, that's right.
And then you get in a funk.
That's right. Then you act on it. So we do this on the negative side. All that's required here, let's do it on the positive side because it actually works. And yeah, I think sometimes parents have done this with their children where they can't see faults in their children. No matter what anybody says, my Johnny would never do that. My Johnny's like this. Now, if you think about that, that's you've reasoned that through and you ain't moving from that idea. So you can do it the right thing, you know, you can do it right, wrong. But here we're trying to do it the right way with good reasons. So analytical meditations, they enable you to penetrate and understand an object through reasoning. And the benefits of the analytical meditation is to bring about a deep, transformative understanding.
Yeah, so that's a lot more than just working it out or being like intellectually titillated about things. Mm. It's like actually changing our whole way of being in the world.
And so, you know, you'll find when you study the Lam Rim, for instance, all those different Buddhist topics, right? A lot of it you'll go through and you'll agree. And other stuff you will disagree. But that's will never bring you a deep transformative understanding. Reason like, why? Where's your reasoning? Often it's not there, eh? You just agree. More work's required. In other words, so actually when I was doing this, I took a long time to get this one together because I had to sit there and go, what the heck is an analytical meditation? Because I've been led through them and I've just gone, I can't see how that's analysis. So that's just the review to me. And I'm very bored by that sort of type of meditation. Yet they're called analytical meditations. And I'm going like, no, I don't think that is.
So it's interesting that you said that that we need to have analysis also for the things that we agree with, because it's not enough just to agree with it. That's because, right. You know, we just go, oh, yeah, I agree with that, and then someone comes and challenges it, and then...
And you can find the reason for agreement is wrong. Even that's right to agree, but there's no reason there, or the reasoning is wrong.
Then we're really unstable.
That's right. And then you find somebody who just, you know, get you with the reasoning and suddenly you drop it. Yeah, no. And I need to speed up, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but the nice thing is,
basically said before what's on these other slides. So let's have a look. So stabilization and analysis. So the analysis, so having drawn forth an experience that transforms the mind, one must place the mind intently within that experience without the analysis. Do you guys like understand? So for instance, I'll give you an example. Use here the example of looking outwardly in the world, right? So I see a glittering of something in the distance. I walk over, I see it's these shoes. They look fantastic. They look fantastic. That's one reason they look fantastic. I'll have to go inside and check them out. How much do they cost? They were $1,300, sir. They're now $95. $95? That's a massive saving, right? I could buy those shoes because $95 is better than $1,300. Go just try them on. Sir, they're made in Italy. Made in Italy, that's fantastic. I've got ads. Look at the sole inside. They're like slippers. They are slippers, sir. I get all these reasons, right, to pay $95. So I take it and I stop thinking. I just go, I'll have them. Done my thinking. Done deal. So I take them home. It's the same sort of thing here. If you go through that death and impermanence, right, that's an analytical meditation, which is you're all going to die. All of us. Like, why? You know, so they give you three reasons. It could take place at any time. But why? The reasons. At the time of your death, only Dharma can help you. Why? You get the reason. So once you've gone through those reasons, you know, you come in and go, of course I'm going to die. And I could die at any time. You don't need to think about it anymore. It's done. At the time of death, it's like, you know, will my body help me? No. Will your friends be able to help you? Really limited. Then you're on your own.
So that's the analysis, but the stabilization is to sit with that for a while.
That's right.
Not just panic and go, well, I don't like that. Let's have some ice cream.
That's right. It's got to get in there. So you go, right, I'm studying Dharma. What? I could die at any time, mate. My death is certain. I could die at any time. And when I die, then am I ready for death? You might go, well, no, not really. What are you going to do? Well, the answer is study Dharma. I'm going to study Dharma. Same thing like the shoes, right? You've got reasons for doing it. Then you stop reasoning and then you act. Then you do it. Ordinarily, all these topics are like that in the Buddha Dharma. There's reasons for doing it. So, and if you can bring these two together, calm abiding or states of meditative stabilization and your reasoning, then your mind will not be moved by other thoughts, other ideas, doubts. It stays on that decision.
So that's the protective glass.
Yeah, so I forgot about here's the picture I was talking about. Your inside is protected by concentration, by the calmness. Now, one of the very best meditations you can do, actually, there's really two really, really deep meditations that are fantastic for any Buddhist practitioner. One of them is impermanence, and the other is emptiness. They're the two deepest. You guys, they're not the two most difficult ones, but they bring about the greatest results. Because impermanence stops you clutching at permanence where there is none. And emptiness stops you clutching at self where there is none. And the Buddhist path begins with impermanence. But there isn't anything stable in this world. So we begin with what they call coarse impermanence. So of course, another word for coarse here means easy to understand, obvious. Obvious impermanence in our lives is death, is our death. It's the most obvious form of it. So in other words, our continuum of this life comes to an end, as it has for all the people who are before us. Everyone died. We will too. So we're saying, impermanence in this state means I won't be here after death. I'll be gone like everyone else. That's a simple one. Now, if you take this into a retreat, it's not going to do much for you. You'll sit there and say, well, of course not. It's obvious. It's not going to bring any deep change. What does, though, is subtle impermanence. And subtle impermanence is really talking about what they call momentariness. So, you know, you could look at your whole life as being a series of moments. You could even look at it as being a present. So momentariness is getting this idea is that in the very first moment of anything arising, it falls apart, it disintegrates. So the body which each of us has at the moment is disintegrating while we're sitting here. As we're getting older, the next moment, we're going out. It's like we're going forward and we're going out at the very same time. So and not only that, but it doesn't even remain from the time of the first moment to the second moment. It isn't a first moment, then a second moment. It's the first moment. Yes. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's no description. That's right. That's right. If you get subtle impermanence, you're very close to emptiness. You're not remaining for a second moment beyond the time of its establishment. So the fact that all conditioned phenomena, meaning our body, our mind, everything you see around you, is created in the nature of disintegration. So Why or how? By the very productive causes that brought them into being in the first place. They're impermanent too. So they don't remain for a second moment. What would you be denying?
That
well, your senses just be like everyone's right here, mate.
Yeah.
So that doesn't work. Well, like I said, just here I am. Body's here. Now, so here we come together. Okay, that's the case. What's the reason? So we say, take a product. So a product is anything that's come together through causes and conditions. Your body and your mind have causes and conditions. Everything you see around you is dependent upon causes and conditions. There isn't anything in this room that does not depend upon causes and conditions. The predicate is, what I'm predicating is, that all of these products are characterized by disintegration from the first moment of its existence. So this is the thesis. And we have to have like a reason. Like, so why? Because the reason, the product, whatever it is, persons, minds, walls, colors, whatever, these arose from their own causes with the essential nature of disintegration without relying on some alternative cause for disintegration. Now, what's that sort of saying in terms of gross disintegration, core or coarse impermanence, right? You can have a building standing up there and come along and just knock it over, right? That's some other cause that comes along and knock it over, right? But if you never had that other cause, that building will disintegrate anyway. Yeah. It's just like us here going, well, COVID could be the other cause, the contributory cause to knock me off my perch, right? But let's say I don't get it. I'll still be dead at 100. I'm not going to make 200 whether COVID exists or not. That's what it's all saying. Yeah?
Well, that makes sense. That's a good reason.
So you try and respect, you go on. So products, so there's a way of looking at this. You've got what they do, the forward pervasion, the backward, the reverse pervasion. Each of these three parts has to make sense.
But even like in terms of this impermanence, there are people in this world that are trying to preserve their bodies or extend their lifespans because they don't have that reason.
That's right.
They reckon I can dodge the bullet and never disintegrate.
Yeah, they haven't actually asked this question, like, who is the I? How does that I exist? So they started off on the wrong premise straight away. They didn't do their reasoning. No good reason. And so then, so we have a reason, and these reasons have to be supported by some examples. So here it says, the three worlds, meaning the world that we're presently in, the world of form and the formless world, are impermanent like an autumn cloud. So autumn clouds, especially in Tibet, like they form and they're gone. They change quite rapidly and
they come and go.
Yeah, like the ones over the mountains, you know. It looks like this and then it doesn't, and there's nothing there. Three worlds are impermanent like an autumn cloud. The birth and death of beings is like watching a dance. So this is like, you know, so if you've seen the movies of those the waltzes, when people change partners, that's what happens. You have this partner, they die. You have another one, they die. Next, then you die. It goes round and around.
I'm going
around
to a dance with you.
It's called the dancer. I remember the time we did, I met that guy.
Talked about death all night.
This passage of life is like lightning in the sky. So if you watch lightning, it's brief, isn't it? It's just like, wham, it's there and it's not there. It moves quickly like a waterfall. So you might have heard that, forget his name, the Greek philosopher. You see, you cannot step into the same river twice. So if you look at waterfalls too, it's just, you know, it's emotional all the time. It just pours down and
that's always the momentariness, isn't it?
Yeah, it's momentariness there. So you take these things and you know, you sort of think of them, to think of them or reflect upon them and draw this conclusion. This is right. This is right. This is right. This is not false. That's not wrong. So you go, okay, I can take that, these examples, and I've got this reasoning. I can put them together. And then it's like, what does that mean for you? What does it mean? So one of the great things about a person is like, this could freak you out in a way, right? But it's not all bad news. So with concentrating on this idea of impermanence, things being subject to change, just because they're produced by causes and conditions, their own causes and conditions, stops you grasping at anything to be permanent. There is nothing permanent in this room, for instance. So if you could hold the mind onto impermanence, its reasons, this idea, you won't.
So this comes back to what you were saying about the distraction, the three different ways to deal with a distraction.
A distraction. Yeah, so then in terms of the analysis, right? So then it undermines grasping at it. So grasping means believing. Right? So you undermine your belief in permanence where there is none. And yeah, what will happen to you, because this is what happened to me, it's like, you won't, like, what am I going to do? That's what comes down. It's like I'm here, what am I going to do when this is the reality? And lastly, it's awareness. It spurs you on to engage in, like, what's the greatest benefit? What is the best thing I can do when my life is subject to impermanence? So we have to find something that's beneficial for us now and in the future. Now, like I said, the wonderful thing about impermanence is that it can oppose the afflictions. You can use this understanding to oppose afflictions. So which afflictions? Here we're going to look at desire and anger. So whatever the object is that you desire or have desirous attachment towards, you must understand it's disintegrating while you're engaging with it. So the object itself is not permanent. Not only that, the wonderful thing is the mind of attachment will also change, is subject to change while you have it. From the very first moment, it's already subject to change. What stops it, or it doesn't actually stop it, what makes it appear permanent is your grasping again. You keep going back to the object. Have you ever had those things? I've had this often. One was, a long time ago now, when I was at school, there was this girl who's, you know, I was 13, 14, fell in love with this girl. She's beautiful, in my mind, right? So I've always had that image of her. I saw a picture of a little girl on the Facebook, right? She's same as me now, 67, right? Man, I couldn't even recognize her. She's this little old lady with glasses, square glasses. And it's like, no, that's not her. Here's her name. That's her. That's not, you know. And then I go, well, that's not a beautiful, not anymore. So that's what we do. I mean by grasping or holding on to beliefs and things, they don't exist that way. They're subject to change.
When I've seen friends after like 5 or 10 years, and my first thought, and thank goodness I didn't say it, was like, oh my God, what's happened to your face?
That's right.
It's gone all right. Drooping, but actually it's like just age.
So what's, you know, this is just once again trying to bring the reasoning in. Like I said, there's only a few things that are permanent. You can put them aside. Just focus on what's impermanent, subject to change. Why? Because whatever the causes that produce them are disintegrating the very same time they come into existence. There isn't anything stable in the world. So it's good news in terms of anger, isn't it? You just can't be angry all the time. It's impossible. You can't have lust all the time. You can't keep always having a mind of attachment all the time. Larry Davis said, so I found this and I thought, wow, I love this quote. People in this world wander, full as it were of suffering. Why fill with suffering people who already suffer? So I looked at this quote and put up with us in terms of attachment, desirous attachment, and anger. You push that out onto people. People are already suffering. Why do you want to do that? You're not adding anything good to their lives. But that person's suffering. You just, I'll add some more. Right? Go, no. No, I'm going to restrain myself. So they gave this analogy, which I'll quickly read. There were two brothers whose father had died in the presence of one and whose mother had died in the presence of the other. When they made each other miserable, which was not the slightest use.
What kind of story is that?
When they met, because they told each other.
The end.
That's it. That's it. Yeah, yeah. So it's like saying in this way, so I've got attachment and anger, and then I meet you and I want to have this relationship with you. Yeah, let me add to your problems.
So now we've got this dance and there's the miserable verses and they meet and they have a totally miserable time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I haven't seen you for so long. Let me tell you what's happened. My mum died. Ah, well, Dad died. How do you feel? Anyway, I think it's a lovely caution. So say like, hey, you want to have a relationship, you want to get involved with anybody, why? What's the purpose? Remember the purpose, right? Don't just get into it through attachment or aversion. So between sessions, if you are a Buddhist already, like guard your vows, accumulate as many causes as possible, which obviously just means study, try and, like in this class at least, get this reason down. Because there's a lot of analysis goes on in Buddhism. Look at the different topics, say, well, why? What's the reason? Come, remember that. Try to question the material. Now, here it's not so bad, I think, in terms of impermanence and guarding the senses. It's all right. Just don't bring into it the grasping or the aversion. Because, like I said, if you keep recognizing impermanence, it puts a huge dampener on desirous attachment to other people and another huge dampener on being angry towards them. It just doesn't. What's the point? And continue engaging it. Continue thinking about it. So in brief, this is what we've gone through. Look at, you know, the stabilizing meditation, the resetting of the mind, course distraction and distraction, the antidotes. And then we looked at analytical meditations and in particular, impermanence and the reason for it. And... Okay, so supplementary readings. Pages 15.
There's some concentration right there.
That's right. I got it here. Though. So page 15, and the other is page 20 and 22. That's for supplementary readings. On the meditation extras, page 7 to 9. Look at that, analysis and impermanence, which you've just done. This is called distraction.
Yeah, actually, this is the co-host distraction because I'm the one that went through the PowerPoints. I didn't notice that at all.
Yes.
So next week is on?
I don't know.
It's a forgotten. Surprise.
Forgotten. Yeah, surprise. That's right. But we'll still be on course. So I mean, we've put some effort into this. I think it's been a decent enough class, something to learn. We've learned something. Hopefully we'll try and put it into practice best we can. So we'll take that merit, which is impermanent, subject to change. Does exist in mere name, though. So we're going to dedicate it towards the enlightenment, which does not change and exists in mere name. For the benefit of all sentient beings have been very kind to us, helped us live in this life, and put us all these different lives, and, of course, of coming into contact with teachers who have taught us, I think, these wonderful teachings, so we can behave rationally and validly in the world and put it into our suffering and the suffering of others. Okay, thank you, everyone.